Just like to thank our musicians and singers for that this morning. I was standing up the back having kittens, and I felt like I was floating above the floor. It's really nice. Hello, Myrtle. Nice to see you up the front. I've got bad news for you. You've probably heard this already, but if you look on a packet of Lego, it says suitable for ages 4 to 99. So tomorrow, officially, you've outgrown Lego. So I'm very sorry to tell you that. I wanted to start off today with a little bit of poetry. I don't know much poetry, but this is a bit of poetry that actually is to do with another matriarch who was also born in 1926. And her name is Elizabeth, that is correct. Here she is. 1963, Queen Elizabeth II and her husband Prince Philip, that's not him. They visited Australia, and the then Prime Minister of Australia, Sir Robert Menzies, welcomed her to Parliament with a short speech that emphasised the value he saw that the monarchy provided to the people of Australia. And he closed the speech this way. He said, "All I ask you to remember in this country of yours is that every man, woman and child, who even sees you with a passing glimpse as you go by, will remember it. Remember it with joy. Remember it in the words of the old 17th century poet who wrote those famous words, 'I did but see her passing by, and yet I love her till I die.'" Now, why do I tell you this? Because, oddly, the context of what I'm talking about today has a lot to do with the idea of passing by. Does that make sense? No, it doesn't. But it will, hopefully. That's the framework of what we're about to discuss. But really, what this sermon is about is if you feel in a bit of a rut with your spiritual journey, that you might be lacking vitality or spark in your connection with God, like you're a bit dried out, a bit parched, I'm going to be giving you the tools, or at least a tool, in this sermon that science shows will help to rewire your brain and inject some vitality so that you and I can be less self-focused, more alive to the possibilities and potential that comes from following Jesus. That sounds like a big promise. Let's see what happens next. So we're going to be in Mark chapter 6, and this is a busy chapter, if ever there was a busy chapter in the Bible. It's a chapter that opens with Jesus preaching in his hometown of Nazareth to a skeptical reception, then the sending out of the 12 disciples, then John the Baptist gets beheaded, the disciples come back to Jesus, they try to withdraw to a quiet place, thousands of people follow them, Jesus feeds them with 5 loaves and 2 fish, and finally, just to cap it all off, Jesus walks on water. It's a chapter that is made for the TikTok generation. If you've got a short attention span, well, this happened, well, this happened. And I'll finish with that, so I'll move on to the next thing. Anyway, it's the walking on water bit that we're particularly looking at today. Yeah, okay, that just needs to advance, oh, thank you. Right, so when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he, Jesus, was alone on the land. He saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. About the fourth watch of the night, he went out to them, walking on the lake. He was about to pass by them. But when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost. They cried out because they saw him and were terrified. Immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take courage, it is I, don't be afraid." Then he climbed into the boat with them and the wind died down and they were completely amazed. So here's the situation. The disciples had been in a boat on the water rowing probably for hours. And they're still in sight of Jesus, who is high up on a hilltop. Now, being on a lake, rowing when the wind is against you, that is not a fun experience, because wind means waves. And waves mean three things. One is they're forcing you back in a way you don't want to go, so you're not making a lot of progress. The waves mean you're going up and down. And, of course, you've got water splashing into the boat, so the boat's getting heavier and heavier and harder to move forward. And they've been at this for hours. So Jesus seems to think, well, okay, I've finished praying now. I should go out there and perhaps I could help them. So he goes out to them, walking on the water, walking on the waves, What does that look like? I don't know. It's really hard to imagine that. So he comes out to help them, but as the text says, he doesn't go to them. The verse says he wanted to pass by them. Pass by them? Now, don't get me wrong, but that doesn't sound very helpful. It's like, hi guys, I'll see you in Bethsaida, or something along those lines. Looks like you're in trouble, but I'm just passing by. So what is really happening here? And I'd point out that this episode is not recorded quite like this in the Gospel of Matthew or John. It's unique to Mark. So what is Mark, the author, getting at when he says Jesus wanted to pass by them? Rather than being something a bit weird, it's more likely that it's something quite profound that's going on here. It's actually a callback to two remarkable episodes in the Old Testament, one involving Elijah and one involving Moses. I'm just going to look at the Elijah one today because we don't do everything. Now, Elijah was a great prophet of the one true God. He did mighty things, but he also demonstrated real human weakness and frailty. So at his time, there was a major issue in Israel, and the country was really just going down the gurgler spiritually because King Ahab, Queen Jezebel, they couldn't care less about the real God. They'd kind of set the nation on the course of Baal worship, so the worship of false gods, made-up gods. And this culminated in a showdown at the top of a mountain between Elijah in the red corner, or in that corner, representing God, and 450 prophets of Baal in the blue corner to see who could call on their God to rain fire down from heaven. So it's a pressure cooker atmosphere. There's 450 of these guys prancing around. They're cutting themselves. They're doing all sorts of weird things. So it's one against many. And it should be no contest because Elijah is just outnumbered. And it is no contest because the Baal prophets had no hope. And it's clear that Elijah's God is the one who is worthy of worship and respect because he's the one who could actually call down fire from heaven. So he had this great triumph in the name of the Lord. But curiously, that whole episode just did something to Elijah, and he took off, and he ended up hundreds of kilometres away in a cave in a mountain, exhausted, overwhelmed, and just not wanting to even go on. And at that point, he hears a message from God. The Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." And then you have a great wind coming, but the Lord's not in the wind. The great earthquake, the Lord wasn't in that. Great fire, the Lord wasn't in that. And there was a gentle whisper. And that was where the Lord was. So Elijah had this very personal encounter with the living God who passed by. And it changed the trajectory of where he was heading. And he was able to get up and go on with his ministry. So the idea of God passing by is sort of like a shorthand way of saying having a remarkable, life-transforming, vivid, personal encounter with God at a time of trouble and crisis. And Moses had an encounter even earlier in time with some similarities to that, also at a time of crisis. We're not going to go into the full details of it now, but just briefly, Exodus 33, Moses said to God, "Now show me your glory." And the Lord said to Moses, "I'll cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I'll proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence." And just to boot home the similarities between Moses and Elijah, it's the same mountain. It was the same mountain they were both on. There was Mount Sinai and Mount Horeb, the mountain of God. So, as I say, for the Lord to pass by or pass in front of is code for a vivid, personal, dramatic, supernatural encounter with God. So, When Mark records what Jesus is doing, that he wanted to pass by them, Mark is really saying something very specific, very meaningful. He's connecting that to Moses and Elijah. And Jesus wanted the disciples to have a vivid, dramatic, supernatural encounter with God at a time of crisis or challenge. So at least one of the things he's doing by this is not just saying, "Look, I can do miraculous things by the power of God." If you think about it, he's really saying, "I am God." And the reaction of the disciples? Well, they were utterly astonished. They were completely amazed. It blew their minds. And I use that term quite deliberately because In recent years, psychologists have gone to the trouble of researching the impact of awe and wonder on the brain, what it actually does to the way our brains work. Because we might think that the experience of awe is just some passing feeling. It doesn't really amount to much. And turns out, that's wrong. I'm not going to download all the data on you, but it seems that the experience of awe changes our brains. Last year in Brisbane, there was a World Science Festival. Who knew? And they had a panel discussion, they did a whole lot of things, but they had a panel discussion with brain specialists and psychologists. I think there was an astronaut on the panel as well, talking about the science of awe and wonder. What measurable effects awe has on the working of the human brain. And one of the impacts, and there's going to be a few of these, let me start my list. First one is cognitive expansion. Love that term. So what that means is that our brains, in normal life, our brains are continually building like a predictive model of what is going on around us. We pick up patterns in our little lives and we store them and we use them to help us predict what we think is likely to happen next. But when we have a moment of experiencing awe or wonder, that literally blows the doors off that predictive model thing. It forces the brain to basically reset that predictive model function and go, well, you didn't see that coming, did you? So it literally opens the brain, expands the brain to new understanding, new picture, a new model, a new way of seeing things. It's cognitive expansion. And you can see how that might help the disciples in their transition from fishermen to apostles, which most of them were fishermen. So fishermen, their world was kind of small. It's kind of limited. They had nets. They had boats. They probably lived their whole lives in one village. They had some experience of where to find the best fish, at what time of day, or what time of year. And they meet this guy who seems kind of different in the way he talks and thinks and interacts with people. But that's okay. Maybe they can still fit him into their usual understanding of the world. He's a teacher. We understand teachers. He's a really good teacher. We can handle that. Well, that's not going to work. They need that mind reset. They need that cognitive expansion. They need their worldview blown wide open so they can allow a totally new idea to take hold in there. And that idea is that this guy, Jesus, is actually the Son of God. And so they go through this walking on water experience and other experiences that involve awe and wonder at what Jesus does. And in this passing by episode on the lake, they are recorded as being utterly astonished. So the experience opens their minds enough to allow this radical new idea to take root in a way that will shape what they do for the rest of their lives. And that's just one of the things that science has found out that awe does. There's another thing. Apparently our brains have something called a default mode network, which means nothing to me, but what that basically is that self-talk in our brains, that rumination, that autobiographical thinking that's going, you're really important, you're really important, you're really important. But the experience of awe and wonder actually reduces that and leads to what's called the small self effect. Your awareness of your own self becomes smaller. It means you feel part of something larger rather than just being preoccupied with yourself. And you can see how that might come in handy as a Christian. Or also reduces stress, sharpens visual processing, and I don't know how they measure all these things in like an MRI thing or whatever it is, but anyway, it also increases altruism, kindness, and humility. So overall, you could say that the effect of awe is it helps us to feel calm, yet energized. Now, sometimes in life we feel stressed but energized because all these things going on. Or we might feel calm and lazy, you know, just kicking around doing nothing. But this seems like a sweet spot, calm and energized. Sounds ideal. And, you know, if awe was a pill that you could take, the marketing team trying to sell it would have a lot of things. They could a lot of angles they could work here. And the fact that it has all those benefits means that you can make a good argument for the deliberate practice of experiencing awe is actually a spiritual discipline that we can and should engage in. Back in the late 70s, a guy called Richard Foster wrote a book called Celebration of Discipline, which outlined, I think, 12 practices that can help us to develop as Christians and grow us in our relationship with God. He touched on things like prayer and meditation, study, service, confession, fasting. He didn't mention it, but we're Seventh-day Adventists, so Sabbath keeping is a spiritual discipline that helps us to grow in our relationship with God. And the idea being that for us to develop or grow as a Christian in an environment, in a world that wants to lead us away from God, the spiritual disciplines can help us to stay connected and growing in our relationship. Just like if I want to develop as a runner, there's certain disciplines that I need to do regularly in order to develop. I need to get out there and do things. I need to find a nice long trail and go for a long, slow run on a Sunday morning. I need to have the right equipment and maintain it. I need to eat the right things before running, during running, after running. I need to read the literature to see what other people think about what I should be doing. I need to recover. That's very important. It's a discipline that's apparently, I take it, as a way of developing as a runner. And I need to do the occasional sessions, interval sessions with a coach, and that helps me to develop. They're disciplines that are put in place in order to go forward. But you don't hear much about the spiritual discipline of experiencing awe. Has that been lost? In church history, I think there was a place for that, possibly woven into the experience more than it is now. And part of that was just architecture. You know, if you go to a cathedral that was built 800, 900, 1,000 years ago, I know the Protestant Reformation kind of moved away from awe-inspiring spaces of worship. Not completely, but churches these days tend to be more functional and utilitarian. But honestly, there's something to be said for visiting a cathedral or a chapel like this, St. Chapelle, if you get the chance. You know, the massive high ceilings, the stained glass, just the grand scale and the acoustics that make you want to speak in a whisper. You walk in and you feel it. You feel that sense of all that feeling of smallness in the face of grandeur. So it seemed like that was built 800 years ago, approximately. Architecture seemed like a component of spiritual practice that engendered awe in those who entered those buildings. But there are other ways for us to experience awe. Mandy and I went to Sorrento in Italy about 10 years ago. Mandy was going to a vet conference there. I was there as a travelling companion. So I drop her off at the conference in the morning and I have a whole day to fill in. And we were staying kind of up the hill from Sorrento, so we'd have to walk up and down like 200 steps to get down to the town every time. But we weren't at the top of the hill, so I thought, okay, well, I'll go and explore a bit. So I walked up the hill trying to follow some trails, and it wasn't really well signposted, and I got lost, and I didn't know where I was going, but I thought, oh, well, I'll just keep going higher. Like, if there's an option, I'll just keep going higher. So I followed trails, I followed roads, and eventually I came to this outlook over the Bay of Naples. I didn't take this photo, this is just from the same spot. So it's overlooking Sorrento, that's Mount Vesuvius in the background. To the left is the island of Capri. It's just this beautiful panorama. And of course, I got there and there was a monastery. That's where I was. I was at a monastery there. And I thought, well, that makes a lot of sense. The monastery itself was pretty plain, but you could see why it was there. If you wanted to experience awe, you just had to step outside and open your eyes and take it in. So nature is a source of awe for us. It is, as somebody has described, it's a cathedral without walls, which is a very nice way of putting it. There's a verse in Isaiah chapter 40 that instructs us on this. It says, "Lift up your eyes and look to the heavens." Who created all these? "He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls forth each of them by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing." So that verse is actually a call to observe what God has made, to take it in, to dwell on it, and let that thought, that feeling lift you up to him, to expand your mind. Make yourself smaller. Lose that sense of self. And then there's another dimension to that when you think about that, our response to, say, nature or something else that produces awe. So not only did God create the beauty and majesty in the world and the heavens, he also created people with the ability to see that and respond to it. Here's a philosophical question. If something is beautiful, but nobody is equipped to appreciate that beauty, is it really beautiful? I'm sure the birds in the trees at that monastery could see exactly the same view that I saw, or of the night sky, or whatever it might be. But God made us with the capacity to take that in and respond to it as an exercise of worship. And there are other avenues by which science has shown that we can get those awe-induced effects. But what I'm specifically talking about, the science doesn't look at the God-directed awe, but I am. I mean, you could go to a fireworks display and go, ooh, ah. But that's not quite what we're after. We're after a God-specific, God-directed form of awe. So, for example, the science shows you can experience awe through art and music. But if we come to those avenues, we want them still to be a pathway that directs us to God, like the music this morning, and not just an indulgence or leading to worship of the artist. Let me give you an illustration of what I'm trying to get at here, because it's sort of a tricky area. This is one of the most famous sculptures in the world. It's La Pietà. It's in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and it was carved by Michelangelo. So if you walk into St. Peter's and turn to the right, it's very near the front entrance. And it's just an astonishing piece of work, because it depicts Jesus having died on the cross, sprawled across the lap of his grieving mother, Mary. And it's such an incredible piece of work. You can actually use that as a reason to worship its creator, who's Michelangelo. But that's not what he wanted. I mean, he was 24 when he carved this out of a single 4-ton block of marble. Just the technical ability of it is just extraordinary. But the result is so moving and astonishing. It's actually encouraging to see how Michelangelo viewed his own work and his own talent. Because he said, the true work of art is but a shadow of the divine perfection. So all his work he saw as trying to capture something of the divine perfection of God. Which I think is great, that we can see that, we can be moved by what he made and go, that's just a small reflection of what God does and what God is like. In fact, as an older man, he also said, many believe, and I believe, that I've been designated for this work by God. In spite of my old age, I do not want to give it up. I work out of love for God, and I put all my hope in him. So art, in this way, can lead us to an experience of godly awe, because God gave Michelangelo that ability, and he gave us the capacity to respond. So he clearly had a purpose in mind for equipping both sides of that story. And awe comes out of seeing something created like that, and it should lead us to the God who orchestrated both sides. And we can employ that in that process of rewiring our brains in a good way. Right. Now, you might be thinking, well, I might want to experience a little bit more awe and wonder in my life for the benefits that you have talked about. I'd like to rewire my brain to expand my concept of God and smallen myself in the light of his glory. But I don't have any spectacular piece of nature near me, or I can't get out there that frequently. I don't have a cathedral in my street or an art gallery. What can I do? How can I exercise this spiritual discipline? Well, there is another place to go to that is right at hand for the experience of wonder that leads us right into the very heart of God. And I'm going to try and illustrate this. And this is another passing by story, but it's not Jesus passing someone. It's the other way around. We're going to Matthew 27 as we draw this to a close. So we're in the crucifixion scene here. So two robbers were crucified with him, one on his right, one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down from the cross, and we will believe in him. So what's going on here? Jesus is hanging on the cross. He is in unbelievable pain. Every hour that passes, he is a little closer to death. And then there are these people passing by, and they mock him, they insult him, they deride him, they try and use his own words and actions against him while he's in this vulnerable and broken state. It's a brutal, dark picture. And you might think, where's the wonder in that? All that sounds just awful. It sounds despicable. The wonder is that he stayed. He stayed. Did he have to do what he was doing? No. Was he doing any of it for his own benefit? No. In fact, the very people passing by who mocked him, they were the very people he was dying for. Can you imagine how that would feel? If you were trying to do something incredibly difficult, suffering this much, and you're doing it for people and they were mocking you and insulting you for it, what would you do? Surely you'd want to come down off the cross, which he could have done, and just bang a few heads together. But he stayed. He stayed. He took it. And he took it all the way to his last breath. How do you feel about that? They said, come down from the cross and we'll believe in you. Well, he did come down from the cross and his body was put into a rich man's tomb, and 3 days later, he rose from the dead. And no doubt some of those very people who'd passed by him with mockery in their hearts and voices, some of those people believed and became utterly devoted to him for the rest of their lives because they realised that he did that for them, even in the face of what they did to him at the time. Jesus is the ultimate source of awe and wonder that leads us directly to and into the heart of God. The source that's always available to us when we consider his life, his death, and his resurrection. And those people passing by, who are they? In so many ways, that's me. That's you. That's us. Because there are times when our lives, our actions, our words, our hearts, our rebelliousness mock Jesus. So those people passing by him on the cross, that's us. But in spite of that, of our opposition to him, or even because of that, the man on the cross is there for us. Which means that whether it's the disciples in a boat trying to row across a lake with the wind against them in the middle of the night, or a mocking passerby at the cross who later became a Christian, so us, we can respond with words similar to that old 17th century poet. I did but see him passing by, and yet I'd love him till I die. Let's see.